I'd like to introduce our speaker for today, who will speak until 10:10, and then we'll answer questions from the audience. Let's all welcome Brian.
Hi, my name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Brian.
Hi. It's really nice to be here today. It's really nice. Thanks, Mary, for asking me to come and speak. And I got to take the day off from work to come and speak to you, so that's nice, too, to be with you. I'll just tell you a little bit. I know that I'm here today because I got a hold of the three pertinent ideas that were told about in the book. I was alcoholic and could not manage my own life. No human power could relieve my alcoholism, and God could and would if he were sought, and I get that today. My sobriety date is November 10th, 2004. I haven't had a drink or a drug since then, and I've been with AA and with a sponsor since that time. I have not been sane since that time, and there are many moments, even to today, where I'm not so sane, and you helped me get closer to the mark there the more that I'm with you, and for that I'm truly grateful. I'll just tell you, flash forward to this morning. I woke up, and these were my morning problems this morning. A dog was snoring too loud in the room, and I had to decide whether, one of two other rooms to go into to sleep. I couldn't figure out whether to have breakfast before or after this meeting, when you talk about quality problems, I think it's just quality. I can't even really get to problem at that point, But here's kind of where it started. I didn't really drink much until I was about 17 or 18 years old. I'm an overachiever, so once I got there, I really started strong. But I did start off with, I was wound up tighter than Dick's hat band, basically. I got up from fourth grade. I would get up really early. I'd iron my pants perfectly. They had to have a crease in them. I ironed my own shirts, too. No one showed me how to do that. I just kind of figured it out because I knew it was really important. I was hyper-compliant, I was kind of the opposite of the defiant type of alcoholic that gets here. I got there by the time I got here. I the way I saw the life game going, it's like if I did everything perfectly, I was going to get something. And I knew it was coming soon. So I went and went and went and went. And it didn't show up. Like, whatever it is I thought I was getting for what I was giving, I didn't get. And I know today when I read the book and it talks about, being of maximum usefulness and being of service, which to me sounded like being a can opener when I got here, I don't know. I had no idea that that's how it went. I thought I was going to get something from you. I was going to take something, and I might give something in order for that, but it all had conditions with me, So I was really wound up and, neat and clean, all for me. And you had a word for that when I got here. You explained to me that I had been thirsty for a very long time. I really, really was. Sort of a spiritual malady. For a long while, early in my life, I had a sense that I was loved and lovable. I had a really deep sense of a relationship with God. I had that as a young kid, I won't go deep into this if you heard my pitch before. I loved musicals from a young age, and Godspell. I'd run around singing that, and I really believed it. Bless the Lord, my soul. I was really, I really had that. And I lost it. Because I think, like many of us, I found something in myself that I decided was unacceptable. That if you knew about it, we weren't going to be okay, or that I wasn't going to make it in this world, or I didn't meet the requirements for membership in humanity. Someone was just ready to kind of kick me out, and somehow press pants and a steam shirt and doing everything perfectly that was supposed to fix it. It didn't, but that was going to make it okay. I also start at about the same time, I started seeing everything around me as not good enough. Like this, didn't quite meet my standards. So as your standards grew, my standards grew as well. I grew up in New Jersey, didn't really like the fact that I grew up in New Jersey. Didn't, you know, I thought I should be somewhere else. I read Little Lord Fauntleroy when I was a kid, and I was pretty sure that soon, I don't know if you know that story, but like this scrappy Irish kid from the Bronx suddenly gets whisked back by an English lord and lives in the manor. And I was pretty sure I was that kid. So any day now, someone was going to recognize my wonderfulness, and they were going to, you know, zip me back to the manor to which I believed I was accustomed. I was not. And so, you know, the pressing pants continued. At any rate, that's kind of how I started out. I was pretty sure that I was special, more special than you, and also really more defective. And I know now that that is, you know, a piece of the alcoholic. We just are phenomenal, stupendous at being both better than and less than at the same time, and really warping ourselves into insanity as a result of it. So, I finally had that drink by about 18. I was going away to college, and I decided that I needed to practice so that I didn't embarrass myself when I did start drinking, because I knew that some bad things could result. So I took the bottle that I knew would be missed least, which was like Harvey's Bristol Cream, and a tumbler. It was kind of... And no offense, it was just a very grandma kind of thing to do, you know. I don't know if I was watching Merv, but it was that kind of thing, you know. And I drank it in secret, and something happened there. You know, I had, it's the effect produced by alcohol. I had this experience where I focus a lot on myself and my clothing. And I remember thinking, it was the feeling of like, wow, these pants look great on me once I had a drink, you know. And other things seemed to matter less, you know. And then soon I drank with other people around it, and I noticed I felt really charming and secure around them, and it was easier. It was easier at that point to be with other people when I was numbed that way. And I thought it was easier. They had different things to say. And, you know, friends from college would report that it was really tough to be around me. I wouldn't remember what happened. You know, those are blackouts, I now know. I thought those were, like, part of the game, you know. I thought that's why you drank, was so that you had fun rehashing the next morning what had happened and you know, figured out, well, how did I get out of that? Because I was like Mr. Magoo kind of from the get-go. Sort of like, how did I get there? And I know now that that was really just a loss of control, that there was, you know, from really early on, there's a powerlessness and an unpredictability that came with my drinking that made me dangerous for me and very dangerous for you. I'm not a violent guy. I'd start fights. Really, I would just throw arms toward people and miss them, luckily. So I still have, you know, my teeth are intact from any use of alcohol or anything like that, but it wasn't for... attempting in some way. What I know most of all is what I was like without a drink, and that says a lot more to me about my alcoholism than about the alcohol. If there was a night where we couldn't get beer in college, everybody else would be like, okay, we'll do something else, and I would be absolutely overwrought, like furious that we couldn't get our hands on something. This was ruining everything, and I believe now is because I knew I couldn't really tolerate doing relationships with other people, mixing with other people, without something in me to mix me up a little bit. I had this moment of clarity when I finished college, and I had a couple of jobs, and I had to be at one at 5 a.m. to open a health club that will be relevant in a second. And it was tough to show up there and still have, like, the booze of the evening before oozing out of your pores. New York Health and Rocket Club didn't really like that you smelled like beer when the early morning workout people were coming in. So I got that, you know, hey, I really can't drink like this anymore. I can't really go on like this. I'm tired during the day. You know, I got on some level that was unmanageable. So I just traded drinking for the cousins of alcohol and just went from one to the other in succession. But it's like that kid song, "There Was an Old Lady Who Swallowed a Fly." You know, I swallowed the fly to catch the spider, swallowed the spider to catch the fly. I don't know why I started the meth eventually, but it was because of the alcohol originally. And that's kind of how it went for me. And it just spiraled down from there. When I eventually, got to the doors of AA, I had ripped through a lot of really valuable things in my life. I didn't so much want my family anymore. I certainly didn't want several careers that I had started and left. You know, I would sort of get in the door, and they'd want you to show up early or on time for work. I was not good at that. I never felt like I was promoted quickly enough. And quickly enough for me meant, you know, I'd get pretty good opportunities, like pretty exciting stuff too. I got to work at a casting office at one point, and you know, I had been hired on as an intern, but they gave me a full-paying job, and I did not see my rise there as meteoric enough in 3 months while I was calling in sick very often. I thought if you didn't use all your sick days in a year, that you were a really good employee, by the way, that if you weren't exceeding them, you were hitting the mark, you know. So, and meanwhile, you know, showing up hungover almost all the time. But I left career after career after career. I've had... several different open, like, what do they call it? Entry-level positions, but no real, like, jobs in them, you know, and eventually I just decided I'd go to law school. You know, I'd go to law school, and law school would change me. I would, you know, clean it up, I'd get everything together, and I did. I stopped drinking and using completely for the whole time that I was there. I never had a program. But it helped me immensely when I got to AA, because when I read that section about in More About Alcoholism, about here are the methods we tried, I love that. It makes it sound like we had lab coats on and we're out there like scientifically checking things, you know. But importantly, for what's important for me in that is that there was something scientific about it, because when people approached me, you know, it talks in that section about when family members approached, or professionals approached me, you know, a lot. It was that way. I would get super defensive and have a lot to say about the scientific ways and the justifications that I had about how no, this is really, that may have been a problem when I was going out and drinking a lot of beer, because I get, you know, thirsty. I was worried that this is evidence of my alcoholism. When Mary handed me this water, I was like, I don't know if one's going to be enough. But I would have a lot of that evidence about that was true when I was drinking. But you know, now when I'm just staying up all night, you know, the paranoia really drives my productivity, or you know, whatever it was. So. You know, there really was some lame attempts to be scientific in the sort of aftermath of that. Anyway, I really was able to see a lot about how, even though I hadn't tried actively to control my drinking or the things I tried to do in order to stop my drinking, I could really see myself a lot in the book when I got here. You had a lot of ideas about how I should go about this, and I took to this. I got that I was powerless and my life was unmanageable. Didn't really understand or cotton to this idea about spiritual aid so well. So, like, when that got mentioned, I mean, for instance, here's my orientation to it. You know, my mom gave me, being really onto things, gave me the book Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, right? Which is kind of like Saint Easy Does It, or First Things First, or No Big Deals Anymore. I didn't, but I really wanted to hurl that book across the room, you know, toward her. So this idea of just, you know, having a spiritual connection, I didn't really quite get. And fortunately for me, AA is all about practical. I did get the idea that I had a lot of resentments, you know, and I liked the idea that we were going to make a list of the people who had wronged me and do something about that. My first sponsor was really helpful about that when we got to step four, in just saying, like, yeah, just write down think of anyone who, if you were walking down the street and you'd want to go give them a piece of your mind, or if a bush appeared, you would want to duck behind it, and put them all down on the list, and we'll get there eventually. I didn't so much get how seeing my part was going to help, but I went with it anyway. You know, I went with everything that was suggested to me, because I didn't want things to get worse. You know, and if you're here and you're new, and I'm, you know, I'm grateful that there's newcomers in the room. That's how I was when I got here. I just I could not bear things getting any worse than they had been. And what it looked like for me was I was still telling myself that I wasn't homeless, you know, and I wasn't homeless because I was not sleeping on the street. I had a car that didn't run, that I didn't own, but I had a key to, and that's what I had, you know. And I saw somebody on the street last night, my partner and I were going to the supermarket, and this guy's pushing this big cart across the street, and in a way I thought, you know, my hat's off to him, because I get to a point like that and I just couldn't think, yeah, I got it in me, I got another move in me, you know. I didn't have that. I didn't have that when I got here. You know, I faked it a lot. I faked step two because I heard a lot of people saying it's really important to have a God. You know, it's really important to be restored to sanity. And I was crazy. I knew that. I was really crazy, like lockdown crazy when I got here. And haven't been there since AA. So thank you. Thank you very much. You know, I lost my train of thought. I think I'm not grateful about how you've kept me from those places. But at any rate, I faked that. I faked that, and I got crazy enough eventually in sobriety and around some other things that I had to find a God of my own understanding. I had to find a God I could work with, and I just started praying at trees. They were everywhere. I could always see them, and they didn't scare me the way I think that my relationship with God, for some reason, had scared me. And what I found out about that when I did my fourth step was I had let a lot of other people inside of that, in between a relationship that I have with a higher power. And my first sponsor, who had been the priest in my parish, who was just a great, great man and super humble, had said, I need you, kiddo, to never let somebody inside of that relationship again. Many people can help you have that relationship, but never let someone stand in between you and God again. And I kept that bargain with him. You know, right after that, so step three, right into step four, I got that resentments were going to be my number one, they were our number one offender. And my biggest resentment was with my dad. And one of my big problems with staying here was that I looked at his drinking and his behavior as a lot like my drinking and my behavior, only worse. You know, I think because he did it first, or what it did to us. And so I couldn't just see my drinking and my part as being, you know, real similar to that and really parallel to it. I was 18 when the real damage of that occurred for him. And what I got to, you know, watch was my dad lose a career and have to be really humbled to do whatever he needed to do next, to really, you know, deal with a lot of shame around that and what that was going to be like for our family and the people around him. And very slowly to die from complications that are, you know, related to our disease. His was still far, far quieter now that I have a better view of my own, thanks to your help, than mine ever was. But I couldn't see that then because I was really hurt. And I was, you know, at 18, operating at about a five-year-old level, you know, on a good day. You all really helped me with that relationship, though. I think one of the things I struggle with most is I spend a good amount of time with newcomers, but I really fix my star to people in this program who have a lot of time and who've walked a long road ahead of me. And one of my pitfalls is that I want and expect to have decades of sobriety in my behavior and my thinking and my feelings at only, you know, years or months or days. And so when my dad was terminal with cancer, I had no idea what to do, and I had a lot of expectations about what that moment should look like, what his final months should look like, what his final days and funeral should look like, and I kind of had no idea how to do it. You know, we weren't there yet. I had a lot of judgment about that for a long time, and all I did was take direction. My sponsor at the time and another guy in the program who didn't share this with me but was terminal with the same illness at the time just kept telling me the next right thing to do. you know, call every day. Just call every day. And what's your dad like to talk about? And indignantly, I said, the weather. He likes to know what the weather's like in California. And I'm like, call him and tell him what the weather is like in California. And at the end of the conversation, say, love you. I'll talk to you tomorrow. And keep doing it. And I did it, and I did it. And, you know, it was like Tin Man, you know, hollow, nothing inside. But I just did it. You know, and I went to that funeral, and you know, all I did, and Elaine, you really touched me when you were talking about your own experience earlier. I just shook hands with people, hugged people, said thank you so much for coming. You know, your relationships meant a lot with our family. You know, you do a lot for me and for us by coming, and that's it. You know, and again, I felt nothing, but I said an appropriate thing. And I just, you know, went on with it. And I haven't gotten to have feelings about that until very recently, but I kept doing the work recently. And I think if you're a dog owner, you'll understand this. We've got a little Boston Terrier who is, you know, coming into his final stretch here with us, and he's got congestive heart failure. And there's a parallel between him and my dad. This says much more about me and my alcoholism. I treat my pets really well, but this dog is a dick. Sorry if it's a school and stuff, but he kind of is. I mean, he's got an attitude, and when you ask him to go somewhere, he's like really put upon about it, and he thinks he should be wherever he decides to be, you know? And he doesn't know who's in charge. And neither do I. So I had the opportunity and the real gift of bringing him to the vet the other day. And going over there, I thought, you know, I know something's wrong here, and I know that there's something amiss. You know, I don't know what we're going to find out, Riot, but I'm just going to be here with you, whatever it is. And the vet came, and she drew some fluid and left us alone for a second. And I just had the opportunity to say, you know, you are great to me on a daily basis, and you bring so much into our home. And, you know, you've been so good at accepting another dog into your house who steals so much attention and so much focus. And I'm really glad that I've gotten to walk a walk with you. And then I just lost it. And then the vet came in, and she was amazing with me. And I'm so grateful. And I was able to tell her, you're so amazing at what you do with your job. And I appreciate you letting me fall apart, you know, in front of you and stuff. And then she left with the dog for a while, and I was left alone, you know, thinking about the fact that this isn't just about the dog. This is about my relationship with my father too, that I'm so grateful that I got to walk a walk with him. I'm so grateful that AA allowed me to be where I was supposed to be when he actually passed, but that we continue to have a relationship, that I continue to grow in, you know, what that man, you know, did for his family, the sacrifices that he made, you know, despite the sacrifices that I was incapable of making as a kid and understanding at the time. And that somewhere in there were all sorts of feelings of love that I had. And because you all know that, and you know that I need to be able to look back at that experience and know that I did the best that I was capable of doing at that time, given the tools that I had at that moment, that you helped me to do that. So I came here so things wouldn't get worse. I came here so that I wouldn't have to pick up another drink, so that I didn't wake up feeling like I felt on November 10th, 2004, and I've gotten that. And because I've taken more of the suggestions that you've taken over time, I've gotten that and so much more. If you told me that what I came in here for were things like what happened at the vet's office the other day, I would have been like, oh, please, you know. This is not Little Lord Fauntleroy. This is not the stuff that he got, you know. I get so much more, and I get it on a daily basis. And what's amazing is that it feels really good when I get to do it too. It's even better when someone else does. Like, I get to work with people who go back, people who would never have imagined that they'd be treated well or respected in a classroom. I've helped cross the finish line in college. people who never knew how freaking smart they were because of their alcoholism and their experiences that were in the way of that, you know, get to do amazing things. There's people who spoke at this podium today I've been watching since they came in the door. I can't tell you how different they are just because we keep coming back, you know. Well, we don't pick up no matter what. And then we do the rest of the things that are suggested mildly, and so many other things fall into place, you know. I have relationships today that I wouldn't trade for the most exciting, like, well-plotted night of drinking in a million years, you know. But all of that pain is worth it to get to all the experience that I get to have with you today. And I'm really grateful to be here. Thanks.
We have time for two questions, Brian.
This is so unusual. I didn't know about this part. Hey, Mike. Yeah, he's still with us. He's doing okay. Yeah, for today. Like, who does my hair, maybe?
Is he the one that snores, or were you talking about mine?
No, he's... It's by degree who snores. Yeah,
and...
I did, yeah. Yeah. Very alcoholically, my attitude was, I thought you, like, got a law degree, and then people just paid you because you got a law degree for the rest of your life. I didn't know. They call it practice for a reason, just like here, you know, like, practice these principles. And I thought I am, after all, me, and I would show up when I felt like it and kind of do whatever work I suited me, and they would keep me. And a firm that is known, the firm that I worked for in New York City is known as, they never fire anybody. They're so waspy that they're sort of avoidant of that kind of thing. And if the firing looks like they say to you, so where do you think this is going? And that's how people know to leave. But I was actually sat down, and they said, you can tell people that you still have a job here in order to get somewhere else, but you are no longer paid or a member of this firm as of the first of the month. You know? And my response was, well, I've been having some personal problems. and I'm telling you, the guy is either a member of this fellowship, or he needs to, like, work in intervention, because he's just cut me off and said, every person has problems, that's why they're a person. Everyone else deals with their problems. Yeah, it was the greatest thing he could have said. And of course, it was like cotton in ears at the time, you know.